we do not have the funds to mount a cleanup, especially in areas as remote as Alaska.
The federal government is unprepared to deal with Japanese tsunami debris. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 17th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Representative Don Young wants a clear path for energy development on tribal lands.
And this is a classic example of Big Brother interfering with private lands, really, their native lands.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The federal government is woefully unprepared for the tsunami debris washing ashore. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, government officials testified on Capitol Hill today and complained their agencies are underfunded, understaffed, and haven't done nearly enough research.
Here's just a snapshot of the hearing.
We do not have the funds to mount a cleanup, especially in areas as remote as Alaska or some of the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, certainly remote areas. We just don't have those funds.
That's David Kennedy from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. He's in charge of the Ocean Service for the U.S. government. And he goes on, illustrating how expensive, tedious, time-consuming, and frankly, overwhelming the cleanup will be.
Kure Atoll, Hawaii, a small sailboat, 30 feet long, that we wanted to remove. Debris, $1.2 million for that one sailboat in that remote area.
Kennedy says the agency that oversees the cleanup, the Marine Debris Program, operates on about $4.6 million a year. Not a lot of money in government standards, and even less if there's as much floating debris from Japan as some think there is. The government of Japan estimates that 1.5 million tons of debris is floating in the ocean. Kennedy says his agency needs to rely on that figure because it has not produced one of its own. The Marine Debris Program, with only 13 employees, uses satellite images to locate some of the debris, but that's not always the most efficient. And the program relies on mariners to volunteer information if they see anything. The infamous ghost ship that the Coast Guard sank near Dixon Entrance was initially spotted by the Canadian Coast Guard. The problems don't stop there.
Looking at the types of debris, there is virtually no research done on marine debris in the ocean that would tell you if you've got 1.5 million that's floating and you leave it in there for a year, how much of that is still going to be floating and available to come ashore? We don't have a clue.
This was the third hearing thus far on the tsunami debris. There will certainly be more as the bulk of the trash, from soccer balls to buoys to motorcycles, hits land. And as that begins to happen, Senator Mark Begich, who chaired the hearing, worries the agency just won't be able to handle the problem.
It's not like the tsunami didn't happen. It happened. We know about it. No one questioned that it was coming our direction. We just didn't know what level of risk. Mm-hmm. But when asked a simple question of, well, did you plan for it? Did you have some idea? Because that's how you then develop your budget to prepare for such a thing. The answer was no.
The Marine Debris Program does not have the authority to clean up beaches or prevent the waste from washing ashore. Instead, it provides money to companies and local authorities to do so. And with shrinking federal budgets, it's unclear how the needy program will land more money. Senator Begich sums up the problem succinctly.
It's here. How do we deal with it?
If this hearing is any indication, we don't know. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The House Natural Resources Committee passed Congressman Don Young's Native American Energy Act on Wednesday. Among other actions, the bill establishes five Indian Energy Development offices within the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Young says the legislation also holds plaintiffs, rather than defendants, liable When an energy development project on Indian or Alaska Native Corporation land is delayed by what he calls frivolous lawsuits. Representative Young also added an amendment to his bill that voids a Department of Interior rule dealing with hydraulic fracturing on tribal lands unless the landowner gives express consent.
And this is a classic example of Big Brother interfering with private lands, really. They're native lands. If they don't want to have the regulations, then they ought to be able to take and develop their lands as they see fit.
Young says the fracking rule makes tribal lands less competitive for development. There is no word on when the bill will be heard on the House floor. The trial of Peacemakers militia leader Schaefer Cox and militia members Coleman Barney and Lonnie Vernon continued today in Anchorage. The prosecution is still presenting evidence and witnesses. Yesterday, jurors heard from a former militia member who became alarmed at Cox's behavior and another man who said he'd still take orders from Cox. Sam Friedman is a reporter for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner and has been covering the trial. He says Philip Clark's testimony started with his recollection of meeting Schaefer Cox in 2009.
And he was with this group of, it was called Sons of Issachar, and named after the Israeli tribe. And it was based on an idea of, I think, mainly older men specifically, I think Christian men, they specified, who were to be advisors for Schaefer Cox. And he testified that over time, especially as Schaefer got more involved in the militia, he began to be less inclined to listen to them, less inclined to cooperate and do more things unilaterally.
So there was another group in Fairbanks that was sort of operating on principles other than adherence to the federal and state governments?
Well, I want to be clear here. Schaefer, during this time, was a great organizer of different groups. I think I made a list of about seven. And they had different, some were more above board than others. And Philip Clark spoke a lot about the Sons of Issachar. I never thought they were doing anything secretive. They met for, sounds like breakfast or at least 6 a.m. early morning meetings. It was just a conversation group. I mean, they were talking about politics and about, they thought the economy was going to crash and they wanted to be able to prepare for that. But it was never a secret society or anything like that.
And was that part of his expressed concern, was that the Peacemakers militia group became too militant? Or what exactly were his concerns about what was happening with Cox's group?
Well, he had some interesting thoughts about the word militia. As he sees it, the word has been corrupted. It isn't, he thinks, in today in society, it's seen as militaristic and specifically aggressive. And as he saw it, a militia in its organic form, I think as he called it, it's something that is about defending your community and just a group of people getting together to defend their community, which is also how Schaefer defined it as well, I think.
Gary Brockman, another militia member, felt the opposite, it seems, of Philip Clark, that he would still take orders from Cox. What did he have to say about his belief and adherence to Schaefer Cox's ideas?
Well, with Mr. Brockman, there was less testimony about ideology. He was pretty matter-of-fact just about the physical things. He just said he met Mr. Cox at a anti-tax rally and later joined the militia, and that he was a sergeant in the militia and Cox was a colonel. And he took orders from Cox and he talked about physically what he did under Cox's direction.
Did Michael Anderson also take the stand and testify?
Right. I think the most important witness we've had so far was Michael Anderson, who spent about 8 months in jail with Schaefer after their arrest in March. And he testified. His prosecutors originally called him the computer guru. And he testified that he did make a list of various government employees, state troopers, Office of Children's Services, some information about their addresses and other things for Cox, which he later said he destroyed because he was concerned how Cox would use it. And he took the witness stand for about 2 hours.
Sam Friedman is a reporter for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. The trial will reconvene on Monday and is expected to continue into June.
The Air Force says people who live near F-22 bases shouldn't see significant changes in how or where the aircraft are flying following new restrictions that will limit how far away from base the stealth fighter jets can fly. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta ordered the restrictions on Tuesday as the Air Force attempts to figure out what's causing pilots in the jet to experience dizziness and other symptoms of oxygen shortages while flying. The F-22 is stationed in Alaska, Hawaii, Florida, Nevada, New Mexico, and Virginia. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, documenting climate change on St. Lawrence Island.
The seals that lived there, they had to scramble for their lives. A lot of them came to the shore.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your healthcare provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
It's been a busy week for soldiers that make up the 1st Stryker Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division. SKUAC's Emily Schwing reports the soldiers yesterday celebrated their return from Afghanistan after a year-long deployment.
The Army Band played music as the Stryker Brigade soldiers lined the runway at Ladd Army Airfield on Fort Wainwright to recognize a change in command.
Today I am the luckiest man alive. I was truly blessed to have commanded this brigade and want to thank all of you.
That's Colonel Todd Wood. After commending the brigade on a mission accomplished, he officially signed off.
Strike first, strike hard. Arctic Wolves, Arctic Tough. Wolf 6 signing off the net. Wolf 6 out.
Wood passed the colors to Colonel Brian Reed, who says he looks forward to commanding the only brigade of its kind.
There's only one Arctic-based brigade in the United States Army, and that's us. So we're going to embrace that mission. In addition to being a Stryker Brigade Combat Team, we're also an Arctic-based brigade, so there's some skills that go along with it that we need to be masters of, so we can do whatever we're asked to do.
The change in command was part of a larger redeployment ceremony. Governor Sean Parnell was on hand to deliver the keynote address.
Welcome back to the Golden Heart City of Alaska. Today, it is summer in Alaska, the land of the free, because you make this the home of the brave.
More than 4,000 soldiers lined the runway of the airfield. There's no word on when or where the brigade will be deployed next. For now, their new commander says they deserve some well-earned time off. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
A memorial service was also held on Fort Wainwright yesterday to honor soldiers killed during the Stryker Brigade's deployment to Afghanistan. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
21 Fort Wainwright-based Strykers were killed during the year-long tour in Afghanistan. Brigade Commander Sergeant Major Bernie Knight asked the thousands who gathered for the memorial to respect and honor them.
Each soldier we pay tribute to here today has touched us all, and I ask you all to hold on to your lasting memories. These soldiers sacrificed more than we can repay and did this unselfishly. They made the greatest gesture one could when they said, "Here I am. Send me."
A memorial marker was unveiled and the names of the fallen soldiers were read.
Sergeant Jeffrey C.S. Scherer. PFC Dustin P. Napier.
Soldiers, family, and friends filed past the memorial marker to pay their respects. The procession included Strykers wounded in attacks that killed their comrades. Corporal Cannon Davis, who lost a leg to an IED blast, says soldiers understand the risk, but the reality is different.
Everybody knew that it could happen, that everybody took on the same risk that they did, and they paid the ultimate price, and that's just, amazing. You know, my heart really goes out to the families.
Another Stryker who lost a leg in Afghanistan, Sergeant Steve Jackal, expressed similar empathy and shared feelings about coming home a wounded warrior.
The people of America feel really in debt to us more than I ever knew. When you go to combat, it's either you think of, you're going to die or you're going to live. you never really see the in-between.
Sergeant Jackal says the loss he's experienced underscores his commitment to the country and freedom. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
In the annals of climate change, there's a story that stands out. It's about a hobby that created a scientific legacy. Leonard Apongaluk has a master's in the traditional ways of his ancestors on the Bering Sea's remote St. Lawrence Island. He, like other native hunters, noticed the climate was changing, but he went further. He started writing his observations down. As part of our week-long series on climate change, Johanna Urich has more.
Leonard Apongaluk has more than two decades of daily records of weather, wind, ice, currents, and wildlife in notebooks. He grew up in Gamble, trained by elders to hunt walruses, seals, and whales. Understanding the weather and environment are crucial.
Daily we walk down to the beach bank where we get to observe the ice. How is the ice and the animals affected by the weather?
When he grew up in the 40s, seasons were predictable. Every fall and October, the polar ice pack would arrive with huge multi-year ice streaming out of the Bering Strait to surround St. Lawrence Island, bringing with it walruses, seals, and polar bears. The ice would stay till July or August.
Those were on schedule every year. The seasons didn't change back in those days. They were very consistent.
It's been decades since Leonard Apongaluk has seen those icebergs. Even this winter, which felt like those a long time ago, did not bring them. Instead, most years, ice is gone much earlier and comes back later. Winters have been warmer with only local ice, and not much of that. There are years with open water near the island.
Now, our conditions are unpredictable. We get these freak storms that come into our area. Winds are higher, more inclement weather. It disrupts our planning.
Over 20 years ago, Apongaluk started writing down his observations. It was a way to help him decide when to hunt. The notebooks go way beyond temperatures, wind, and ice cover. They include wildlife observations and are a detailed view of a world changing. They are the largest baseline of data set of its kind in the Arctic. Igor Krupnik with the Smithsonian Institution saw the value. He worked with Apongaluk to write a book based on observations from native hunters. Changes Apongaluk recorded include the first time whales stayed in the open water near the island during the winter instead of going further south, polar bears coming on shore instead of following the ice, and storms so violent one broke up the ice, driving ice seals onto shore.
When the ice got crushed, waves got bigger. All this ice pounding with, you know, each other, and the seals that lived there, they had to scramble for their lives. A lot of them came to the shore, and some of our people hunting them, they started to go out over the ice despite the danger, and I was hoping they would make it out. That was one thing that, where I saw the seal in danger in his own environment, where the animals fought for their lives.
None of this would have been conceivable when he was a boy. But this is the reality today on St. Lawrence Island for younger hunters like Perry Pangawi. To help them hunt, his generation accesses satellite images.
This gives us a bird's eye view of where the ice is.
New technology coupled with eons of traditional knowledge helps safeguard these hunters during rapidly changing times. But pressures are increasing, amplified by fuel costs climbing with no end in sight.
Failure is not an option. We have to get that food. We need that food. It gets to be stressful sometimes, especially when we come home with nothing.
Climatic changes coupled with rising costs are things Pangawi calculates on every hunt. I'm Johanna Urich.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
The largest herring fishery in Alaska has been hampered the last few days by weather and unripe fish. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The Togiak herring fishery opened Monday night, but thus far the total harvest is quite small. The gillnetters have not reported any harvest, and the Purse Seine fleet has only harvested just over 2.3 thousand tons of herring. On Wednesday and Thursday, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game issued emergency orders changing the area open for the gillnet fleet to use due to strong winds that are expected to continue through Saturday. Tim Sands is the area management biologist, and he says the low harvest thus far is due in part to the weather and herring that are not yet of commercial quality.
There's definitely mature seine fish, but the gillnet fish weren't mature, at least in the traditional area by Kaluka, when they were able to test them.
The gillnet fleet is allowed to fish uninterrupted until further notice, while the Purse Seine fishery is currently scheduled to close Friday night at 10. Sand says the weather is not ideal for either fishermen or the fish.
When it's this windy, we don't necessarily think the herring are spawning. We think they're holding off too, because you can imagine a surf on the beach, and that's kind of where the herring go to spawn, and they don't want to be in there when there's big waves coming on the beach.
The quota of herring available in the Togiak Sacro herring fishery is over 24,000 tons, and so far just 2.3 thousand tons of herring have been harvested. There are apparently 16 or 17 seine vessels participating this year, and Sands personally counted 13 gillnetters during an observation flight Tuesday. Sands admits to concerns that the herring might spawn out before the quota can be caught or even approached.
Because instead of, you know, the capacity that we have is enough to, it would take 10 days to process the whole quota, 10 or 11 days even. So it's always been a concern that the fish won't hang on for 11 days and be of the quality that the processors want.
There are other complicating factors that could impact the Togiak herring fishery, including that the 24.7 thousand ton quota is broken out with the Purse Seine fleet getting 70%, the gillnetters getting 30%. If the gillnet fleet can't harvest fish, that might mean that the Purse Seine fleet could be restricted in some manner. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
When you hear the word graffiti, you don't necessarily associate it with something cozy. But if you're looking at a yarn bomb, that's essentially what you've got. Yarn bombing, also known as guerrilla knitting, involves covering public structures or objects in a colorful, non-permanent way. And UAA just got tagged. APRN's Heather Arono has the story.
The Balancing Arcs statue, also known as Happy Man, sits at the entrance of UAA. During the summer, it's a fountain. Throughout the winter, it functions more as a stoic welcome to the campus. But at the end of the spring semester, the Happy Man looked a little different.
We basically made him a sweater. That's what we did.
That's Coleman Alguire, a freshly minted UAA graduate from Ketchikan with a degree in justice and a minor in art. Alguire, 22, is just finishing up a fiber structures class, which teaches knitting and weaving among many other forms of textile artwork. Alguire says he and the students in his class were interested in drawing attention to the fiber arts program in an eye-catching way. Inspired from watching the film Handmade Nation, he says a yarn bomb seemed like the right course of action.
And you want to leave a mark somewhere, but you don't want it to be permanent, and you don't want it to be destructive to something else. And so if you take knitting and just apply it to a surface, you've completely changed the meaning of the surface, the type of surface that it's applied to, the texture of the surface, the color, and it adds all of this background information to it.
The yarn bomb is made up of a collection of multicolored knitted pieces that were connected mostly using twist ties. Alguire says he wasn't at all concerned about someone being offended by putting it up.
It's yarn.
Yeah,
It's very removable, and that's the greatest thing about yarn bombing, is that you're doing this thing, you're doing this gesture, this guerrilla gesture that takes people, and they notice it, but it's not permanent.
Alguire's fiber arts teacher was fully supportive of his guerrilla tactics. In fact, she assigned it. Karen Lowell, the fiber program coordinator, likes to integrate one assignment in her classes where students don't ask permission to install their art. They just put it up for a little while and then take it back down.
I like the idea of having a creative gesture that makes people look at their physical environment in a different way.
Lowell says a few years ago she didn't really give gorilla knitting a whole lot of thought because she had only seen it done on a small scale. But after she saw the 2010 Christmas Eve yarn bomb on the Wall Street Bull in New York City by artist Crocheted Olick, Lowell says she was impressed.
And that's ballsy. That's badassery. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing. It's like, all right, that's the kind of thing you can do. You can only do that with fiber. You can't. What else? What would you use to do something like that? So she's my personal hero.
Lowell says the yarn bombing of the statue at UAA isn't just to draw attention to her program, but it's also a way to draw attention to the structure itself.
We just get numb and things do turn invisible, just with familiarity. And so, yeah, it's another way of calling attention. And we picked that one because it is formally very strong. You know, it's got the little paired arch of the legs and then the upraised arch of the arms and then the head. And formally, you can put plainer material on it and it looks good. So you call attention to something that has turned into the backdrop.
As part of the project, Lowell, Alguire, and a few other students removed the yarn bomb 2 weeks after it was put up. Lowell says plans for the next project will begin when the fall semester starts. In Anchorage, I'm Heather Arono.
You can go to alaskapublic.org to see photos of the UAA yarn bomb. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Johanna Urich in Anchorage, and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Heather Arono from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time home buyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.